Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm your host, Hugh LaFollette. On the show this morning, I'm talking to Ira Berlin, professor of history at the University of Maryland, and our topic will be slavery. Professor Berlin, glad to have you on the show.
Delighted to be here, you.
To get us going, I want us to listen briefly to a clip from a show in which you were involved producing voices from some former slaves. Here's the clip.
We were slaves. We belonged to people.
See, the white folks would have church in the morning, then they'd let the colored people have church at their church in the evening.
During slavery.
During slave time.
I can remember when the Yankees come through.
Well, now, they tell me to the year for the folk know they were free.
See, the old master come in for me. He quit praying and then asked the Lord, have mercy on the old master. Lord, have mercy on the old master. Old master was hooping with a bullhook.
If I thought that I'd ever be a slave again, I'd take a gun and just end it all right away. Because you're nothing but a dog. You're not a thing but a dog.
All right, perhaps, Professor Berlin, you'd like to talk a little bit about this, the significance of what we heard, and maybe even a little bit about the show, which this was part of.
Well, this is part of a show called Remembering Slavery, which is has been both a radio series, which perhaps was played on your own station, and also an audio book, that is a book and a tape set published under the title of Remembering Slavery, African Americans that talk about their personal experiences in slavery and emancipation. The voices are drawn from interviews which were done during the 1930s and 40s with former slaves, in which former slaves tell us about their experience in slavery and talk to us a little bit about what they think the meaning of that experience in slavery was for themselves and for ourselves as a people. And I think from those voices, even from the little bits and snippets we heard here, I think two messages come out, two very important messages. One message is that slavery was an extraordinarily violent institution. It was an institution which rested on force. When the force disappeared, when the Union Army arrived, the game was over and slavery was done with. But during its 300 years history and mainland North America, slavery was about force and violence and imposition and psychological imposition and physical imposition of the meanest and most brutal kind. And I think the voices that we heard, Fountain Hughes and others, wanted us to know that and remember that. I think it's very, very important for them. But then there's also a second message in those voices and in the Remembering Slavery text, and that if slavery was about violence and imposition and death, it was also about life. And slaves did not give in to the violence. They did not give in to the psychological imposition. They maintained their sense of humanity. And, of course, the period of slavery, in addition to this long nightmare, was a period of enormous creativity, where new systems of family life, new systems of religious life, new systems of belief were created and sustained by former slaves. And those then remain at the heart of American culture in the years that follow, and of course are one of the great inheritances of the slavery period. And these two things, contradictory things in so many ways, the violence, the imposition, the nightmare of slavery, and the enormous period of cultural creativity of music and song and dance and language and theology, of philosophy, of politics that was created during the slave period by Africans transferred to the New World and their children, I think is at the essence of those tapes.
All right, let's spend some time elaborating on some of those themes. And I want to more or less follow the outline that you do in this talking book you have, the audio book. One of the first things you talk about is, in elaboration of what you mentioned earlier, the unequal power relationships between slave owners and slaves and how that shaped the lives of both of them. Perhaps you could talk a bit about that.
Well, slavery was a profoundly asymmetrical relationship. Masters had a monopoly of force, they were not hesitant in using it. They used it, of course, to get what they wanted primarily, that is, the slaves' labor, the slaves' muscle power, the slaves' creativity, and to take that for their own, and of course, in the process, made themselves very, very rich. But of course, if it was asymmetrical, it did not mean that the slaves did not have any power whatsoever. And they took their small scraps of power, their knowledge of the productive system, their understanding about how you grew tobacco and rice and sugar and cotton. And of course, they traded that in for small bits of independence and autonomy, which they used to their own benefit and the benefit of their families.
All right, the part of that power relationship, and certainly I suppose the thing that most people think about when they think about slavery, is the role that work played in the life, that the slave owners required, demanded work of the slaves, and that work somehow shaped their entire lives.
I think that's correct. Work stands at the center of the institution of slavery. Slaves, black people, were not dragged across the Atlantic to ridicule or shame or embarrass them, to demean them in a whole variety of ways, although, of course, this eventually happens. They were dragged across the Atlantic to get their labor power. And in putting slaves to work, slaveholders not only gained enormous wealth for themselves, but they gained dominant power in their own society. So slavery, in addition to being a racial institution, is also a class institution. That is, it allows a few men to gain lots of position and power and domination in their society, and that in turn shapes relationships not simply between black and white, between master and slave, but between and among white people in American society.
Okay, earlier too in your answer, one of the things that you mentioned is the creativity the blacks used in developing new forms of family life. I mean, pretty clearly, the family was very important for the slaves. Maybe you could talk about what its importance was, some of the variations, how slaves fought to maintain their family structure, how slavery tried to undermine it. All those, I think, would be very interesting for the listener.
Well, the slave family will stand at the heart of the culture that African Americans create during slave life. One of the distinctive qualities of slavery in mainland North America, that is what becomes the United States, is the fact that early on there is a rough balance between men and women, and this balance enables African American and African peoples in mainland North America early on to create a family life. Now, this turns out to be a great advantage for slave owners because it will eventually create for them an indigenous slave population so that they can end the slave trade early. And the slave trade to the United States ends perhaps earlier than it does in any other slave-holding colony or nation in the new world. But at the same time that there is an advantage to slaveholders, they interfere in that relationship in a variety of ways, which disturbs and threatens the sanctity of the slave family. Firstly, they don't allow the slave family to have any legal rights. That is, has no standing in law. There is no marriage, a recognized marriage between slave husbands and wives. Parents don't have any right to control their children. Children are the masters property. That allows slave holders to interfere in the relationship between black men and women in very intrusive ways, which are frightening to both men and women, and of course it allows slaveholders to sell slaves, to deal them out like so many cards in a deck across the landscape, separating husbands and wives and parents and children. Now against this, slaves have to find a way to maintain the sanctity of their family. And what they do, of course, is they do this in a variety of ways. Some of those ways are by offering perhaps to do a little bit more for the right to visit a wife, by working overtime, doing what slaves called overwork, to make a little bit of money on the side, or to raise food by which their families will be able to live a little bit better. They do it also by threatening not to do the things which the master wants, by threatening to run away, and indeed by running away, if indeed the master deprives them of rights of visitations or threatens to interfere in the relationship between husband and wife. And eventually, slaveholders understand that it can be very, very unsettling to the order of their plantations if, in fact, they do not recognize the slave family. The slave family, as a result, is always a precarious institution. It is always a fragile institution. It is always an institution under threat. But nonetheless, it becomes the central institution in African American and slave life.
Okay, the other part of creativity which you mentioned was the creativity in culture. You talked a little bit about music, you talked about theology, and in fact, one of the clips we heard earlier, one of the slaves was talking about the role of the church. Maybe you could talk a bit about the slave culture, what it meant to the slaves, how it helped them preserve, I suppose, their own sense of identity.
Well, slaves create their own system of values, which are separated and distinct from their owners' system of values. They did this by distinguishing themselves, what they valued from what their owners valued, and this manifested itself in a whole variety of ways. For example, we know that one of the things that slaveholders did with great regularity was in their own family life was to marry cousins and near relatives in some measures to consolidate property holdings and so on. We know that the slaves in their relations seem to have a prohibition on cousin marriages and rarely do this among themselves. They have distinctive patterns of naming their children and so on. All of this speaks to, in the sense of family, how their culture was different than their owners' culture. And the same thing can be said about the food that they ate, and about the music that they played, about the beliefs that they held, the political beliefs, the beliefs about the relationship between man and God, that is their sacred beliefs, and so on. They're a product in some measure of their opposition to the slave regime. And then secondly, they're a product of their inheritance. That is what is remembered and reconstructed about Africa, and their own unique experience in the new world.
One thing it seems must have also made a difference, perhaps in their understanding of their culture and their family lives and their attitudes toward work, toward slavery itself, was the hope that eventually they would be free. I'm sure early on that was a very vague hope. As talk of the Civil War emerged, the hope became seemingly more realistic. What role did the search for freedom, the belief that they would eventually be free, play in the slaves' understanding of their predicament and of their life?
Well, I think this belief that eventually they would be free, is there, from the beginning. And don't forget that slavery is a 300-year-old institution in mainland North America, in the United States, on the eve of the Civil War. So that belief in freedom is manifested early. It's manifested in people, in running away. It's manifested in slave revolts. But it's manifested, I think, perhaps most clearly in an understanding that's passed down within the slave community, that freedom is our, freedom is our birthright, that this enslavement of us is illegitimate. It's wrong. It's wrong in the eyes of God, and it's wrong in the eyes of man. Now, by the 19th century, this belief becomes very much entangled in Christianity, and by the 19th century, that is, after a long period of resisting Christianization and resisting Christianity, many, many slaves begin accepting Christianity. And as that happens, perhaps the parts of Christianity they come to identify with is, of course, perhaps most closely the book of Exodus and the story of the children of Israel leaving Egypt and becoming free. So that it becomes involved not simply in kinds of understandings of abolition and the political movement in the United States against the slavery and the Underground Railroad, but also becomes deeply embedded in the slaves' sacred world as well.
All right. One of the I'd like to sort of slightly change directions here, but
okay,
before
sure.
I do, I'd like to reintroduce you for the benefit of anyone who might have tuned in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Ira Berlin, professor of history at the University of Maryland, and our topic is slavery. One of the things that you do in one of your other books on slavery called Many Thousands Gone is you try to give a sense of the history of slavery, both how it changes over time and how it changes and varies depending upon location. I think both of those are very interesting. There's a temptation to assume that slavery was the same from the first day it began until the day it ended. We don't have a whole lot of time, but maybe if you could take a few minutes to talk about the way in which slavery began and how it evolved in the United States.
I'd be pleased to do that, because I think that is a critical issue. I think almost all of our popular understanding of slavery is read backwards from the Civil War, when slavery involved growing cotton, when slaves lived in the Black Belt South, when most slaves had accepted Christianity and the Afro-Christian Church became a central institution in black life. Now, for most of the history of slavery in mainland North America, this, of course, was not true. Slaves didn't grow cotton. They didn't live in the Black Belt. They weren't Christians. And so the history of slavery, particularly before the American Revolution, that is most of the history of slavery in mainland North America, is very, very different than we usually suppose. And in Many Thousands Gone, I try to explore that a little bit. Would you like me to talk a little bit about that? Do we have time?
Take a couple of minutes. I think it would be very helpful.
Well, perhaps the people who I become most engaged with in Many Thousands Gone is a group I call Atlantic Creoles. That is the first people of African descent to be brought as slaves to mainland North America. And their lives are very, very different than our pre-Civil War cotton growers. Many of them are coming to mainland North America with a deep knowledge of European society gained by participation in the Atlantic economy. They know a little bit about Christianity. They know a little bit about European systems of jurisprudence. They arrive in mainland North America at a time when many white people, many people of European descent, are also held in systems of servitude. That is, they're unfree. And almost immediately, these Atlantic Creoles get to work integrating themselves into this new society of the New World. They participate in local economies. They are able to gain a modicum of wealth even as slaves by trading and independently on their own. They're able to somehow worm their way out of slavery so that about a third to a quarter of this first generation of slaves gain their freedom. In other words, their experience in slavery is radically different from the way we normally think of the institution of slavery, and they become very, very critical to the formation of African American life. I talk a good deal about them in Many Thousands Gone, the differences among these Atlantic Creoles between those of the Chesapeake and those of Low Country South Carolina and those of north of cities like New Amsterdam. And then I talk about the transformation of slavery, which I see taking place with the advent of the plantation. That is a very different kind of institution, which demands a very different kind of discipline. The Atlantic Creoles are pushed, are ousted, are overwhelmed by a new generation of slaves who come not so much from the Atlantic periphery and knowledge of the larger Atlantic world, but come deep from the interior of Africa. They have very little knowledge of Christianity, of European jurisprudence. They are not allowed to participate in internal economies. Very few are able to gain their freedom. They work harder. They die earlier. There's an enormous degradation of slave life. And with the advent of the plantation, or people who I call the plantation generation, African-American life and slavery is transformed. And I think what I'm interested in Many Thousands Gone is the nature of these transformations and how these transformations change the way black is understood, change the way white is understood, change the very definitions of race.
Would you talk a little bit about that? How did it change the definitions of race?
Well, I mean, we see, for example, our Atlantic Creoles, that first generation, the charter generation of black America. We see, of course, that they are distinguished by their color. And we see that the Europeans degrade them in a variety of ways. They stereotype them. They generally distinguish them as people who are untrustworthy, who are slippery, who are too clever by a half, or who are manipulative, who are not to be who are not to be trusted. But we rarely see them stereotyped in a way that the plantation generation would be stereotyped. And the plantation generation is stereotyped as people who are dull and stupid and dirty and lazy, not people who are too clever by a half, but people who are simply not knowledgeable, and perhaps people who are somehow below the bar of humanity. In other words, the imposition of the plantation transforms the very definition of race. And indeed, we'll see that definition of race transformed again in the era of revolutions, that is, in the era of the American and French revolutions, an era in which large numbers of black people gain their freedom, where slavery is overthrown in the northern colonies, and for the first time, slavery becomes a regional or sectional institution, setting up that bifurcation of American politics between North and South, in which large numbers of black people gain their freedom in the South, in the slave states, the slave states itself. And once that happens, of course, once again, the definition of race changes, because suddenly there are large numbers of black people who are free. They are creating for themselves churches and schools. They're consolidating their family life as a free people. They're beginning to create a wealth and institutions of their of their own. And we see during that revolutionary era, suddenly people like Richard Allen and Benjamin Banneker and Prince Hall and others begin to emerge as recognizable black leaders.
All right, we've really only got about a minute left. Let me ask you, what's the significance of all this? Some people say, well, look, that happened 100 years ago. It doesn't make any difference to understanding of who we are or what we ought to do. And I take it you disagree with that. Could you briefly say why?
Well, I think, as a historian, we have to disagree, with that. That is, slavery is a central institution in forming American life. For most of American history, the United States and the colonies that preceded it were slave societies. The weight of that experience has carried over not simply into the years following emancipation, the Reconstruction period of the late 19th century, not simply into the Jim Crow period and the period of racial segregation, which ended in 1965 with the Civil Rights Act, but into our own times, and of course reflects in memories, in attitudes, in patterns of life, which we're still trying to deal with. W.E.B. Du Bois said the great question of the 20th century was the question of the color line, and I'm afraid the great question of the 21st century is also going to be the question of the color line. I don't think we can fully understand that unless we understand something about how those color lines were drawn.
Thank you very much for appearing in the show.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it a good deal.
I've been speaking today with Ira Berlin, Professor of History at the University of Maryland. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.